got one song to sing for you. This is 1958. Bill Foster, Brooklyn's ambassador to the world. Did you happen to hear the news about what's happening in Brooklyn? I've really got the blues about what's happening in Brooklyn. It ain't official yet. Official, we hope it don't get. But my friends, beware and let me warn you. Look like they're moving our bumps to California. Let's shoot the Dodgers in Brooklyn. A house is not home without some love. Let's keep them on our premises and they would be a nemesis because Brooklyn fits the Dodgers like a...
It has everything that we've come to expect from Wes Anderson. Carefully crafted aesthetics, perfect color palettes, and intricate tableau of actors. That's from Taryn Allen of Chicago Reader talking about our new release this week in theaters, The French Dispatch, from that great director, Wes Anderson. Our old film, the 20th anniversary of Monsters Ball. Halle Berry wins an Academy Award, Billy Bob Thornton fantastic, Heath Ledger, Peter Boyle from director Mark Forster, and our wild card... Well, this is the thing. We got a lot of feedback here, Cody. I look at Apple Podcasts. I take it very seriously. People said this is too much of a boys' club. You know, it's just you and Cody playing grab ass with each other. It's always male guests. How about getting some women? I said, great. So it was great to have Justine Bateman last week. But because we had 55-year-old female Justine Bateman, market correction, we're having 76-year-old straight white male Jeffrey Lyons on the podcast this week. Father of Ben Lyons, noted film critic. He has a new book called Hemingway and Me. Everyone knows I'm a big Hemingway guy, so I actually hit up Ben and go, hey, saw your dad has a book about Hemingway. Could he come on and talk Hemingway? He goes, of course he would. Are you crazy? And, of course, we'll talk movies. In fact, Jeffrey Lyons' favorite movie. You always want to ask a film critic, hey, what's your favorite movie? Mm-hmm. He gives us that answer and lots more as well. So go to Apple Podcasts where you can subscribe, rate, and review. Before we get rolling, I meant to tell you the story of what's happened with The Last Duel, which was 2 weeks ago now. So I normally catch my movies matinees because the kids are at school. So I'm like, all right, I get in and get out. I'm not missing anything, like a noon show. So I'm checking. I need to find like a 12 o'clock show in my area. I see one that's about 15 minutes away, a theater that I'm not familiar with. I'm going to go check it out. Last Duel, let's get it done. I go up there, and it's like one of these like second-run theaters. Like, you know, it's kind of old. You're like, okay, it's not like your local AMC. But I'm like, great. I walk in. No one's there. No cashier. No, like the lights are on.
Oh,
so the
no, I thought you meant in the theater. Like no, it was an empty theater. I just literally open
the door. No, I walk in. There's no one there to greet you. It's like, you know, you buy the tickets inside. There's nobody at the concession. And I'm like, it's just vacant. So I look around and go, hello, 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 hello.
The old hello.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello. Nothing. No. I literally open the bathroom. Hello, nothing.
Was there a bell to ring? I don't know why I've got a bell.
Exactly. You needed a bell. Nothing. I go, okay, I guess I'll just wait a minute. Wait a minute. I go, this is ridiculous. I can't keep waiting. The movie's already... I'm going to see the movie. I just walk down there, and I just see The Last Duel. Open the door, plop down. I'm a plopper. And I just plop down like Susie and Curb. And I just start watching the movie. And I'm like, I'm hoping somebody will come in at some point. I'm like, hey, sir. I'm like, yeah, I was waiting for you. Where are you?
Yeah.
No usher? No one. I watch the film. As I'm walking out, there's a woman there at the front. And of course, moralist that I am, I don't want to get away with a free movie. I go, excuse me. I was... here, like 2 hours ago, trying to find you, trying to see this movie, The Last Duel. And she just stares at me blank-faced, not even apologetic or concerned or taken aback. She just kind of stares at me, and I go, so I wanted to pay for the movie now. She's like, okay. Shrugs. What? Looks it up, and she's like, that'll be $5. And I go, by the way, incredible that it's only $5. Like, I'm definitely going back to that theater, $5 on Tuesday, you know, the $5 Tuesday. But shocking that I was being honest. I thought she'd be like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry, or thank you for being honest. I could have walked out there, Chris Cody, with a... free movie.
That's so weird. There was like, so you didn't get to get a, like, you probably would have bought like a slushy popcorn or something.
No,
like, you didn't even get that.
Absolutely. Right. I had nothing. And I could see it. The popcorn machine was working. I'm like, I could just literally go back there and grab a couple, you know.
I feel like you were looking for an explanation more than anything. Like, what happened a couple hours ago? Why was there nobody anywhere?
You nailed it. I was looking for her to say, oh, I threw up. Somebody was sick. I was coming for someone.
Okay, that makes sense.
I was like, I was here. And she's just staring at me blank faced. Like, so I'd like to pay for my ticket now. I'm like, okay, thanks, $5.
You're a nice guy, man. Look at you.
Well, this brings up the other pact that I want to get into with you specifically is that, are you a monster for not returning shopping carts? A big topic
this
today week, in the Levitard Show.
Yeah, we got into this week.
Can you explain this? Yeah.
Look, man, I said, years ago at this point, it's one of my most, like, I have a few things that I've said over the years that just sticks with people. And I just said that I will... Because someone brought up bringing back your car, and I'm just like, no, I put it in front of my car. If I see a corral near me, I'll put it in that corral.
Yes.
But then people started coming at me like, you don't walk it all the way back into the store?
No.
You're a monster. And I'm like, I never see anybody walking it all the way back into the store. No. I'm with you. Don't leave it in the middle of the spot. I've actually come around on this. I used to be the guy that's like, if it's safely in between the spots, it's fine. There's somebody's job that's to go corral them. I mean, I didn't think it was that big a deal. I just see a lot of glass houses. A lot of people are throwing stones in this category where I guarantee you, look in the mirror. You're not returning your cart the way you're said. Don't tweet at me that I'm an evil monster and this says a lot about the person. No.
Right.
Okay? I'm honest. Okay? I'm saying that I'll put it back in the corral, but I'm like, it's just a lot of glass houses on this topic, I feel.
I totally with you. The worst one is the guy who puts it in the middle of the parking spot. Like, that is just a disaster. Now,
I never said I did that.
But I am 100%
like, I don't think it's an evil trait to just leave it in the safe spot. Like, you know, when there's four cars parked in four spots, there's like that little middle area at the corner of the spot where the lines cross. Right there. You just put the car right there. You're not bothering anybody's spot. And people act like I was a monster.
You're right. If it's close by, I got no issue with that. I'm literally walking 10 to 20 steps. No problem. Great. But if not, I'm not going to go all that way. Somebody has a job to do that. I couldn't do anything more.
It's just, it's really just the culture of Twitter, and people want to like, you're a terrible, it's like, don't do this, okay? Yeah. Just because I'm honest and I admit to you that I don't always, like, just, I'm a human, okay? Yeah. Twitter.
Social media trying to take down Chris Cody. Ain't going to happen. By the way, if you like the podcast, though, tweet us at Cinephile Pod.
Yeah.
Let us know what we're doing well. I do see lots of tweets.
Oh, you're going to tweet. They're going to tweet me. They're going to tweet me, and they're going to say, I bring my cart back. It's like, no, you don't. Okay.
Okay. Those tweets you can directly send to Chris Cody do not include Cinephile Pod. I don't want to read through all those tweets. People lambasting Cody. All right. Let's go to the movies. All right. The French Dispatch, new film from Wes Anderson. He's one of these filmmakers. Listen, when I saw his early work, Bottle Rocket, which was championed by Martin Scorsese and many of those in the independent film circuit, you know, really good movie, quirky, clever. Rushmore is outstanding, comes out in 1998. Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray. Bill Murray in the role of a lifetime. And it's a hilarious movie, coming-of-age story. And then The Royal Tenenbaums, which I think is his best movie. Amazing cast. Gene Hackman, Ben Stiller, Angelica Houston, Danny Glover. So many incredible performances. Owen Wilson. I go, this guy has such a unique vision. He's smart. He's funny, he's clever, and he's got a very unique sensibility. When you see a Wes Anderson film, there's no other film quite like it. However, he followed it up with a bunch of films which I found to be disappointing. The Life Aquatic was a real miss, real big bore. He had a bit of a comeback. The last few films people have liked, although, again, I liked them. I haven't loved them. Grand Budapest Hotel, Moonrise Kingdom, decent movies, but never quite the highs of where he was. We'll do Royal Tenenbaums at some point here on Cinephile, because that's also the 20th anniversary of, again, one of my personal favorite films. So you see this movie called The French Dispatch, and it's kind of like Cody, an athlete that you like. You say, well, he's past his prime, but I got to tell you, that three-year stretch, he was unbelievable. So I still feel like he's going to get back to where he was, even though, no, he's an aging athlete at this point. He's just going through the motions. And that's in many ways what Wes Anderson is doing with The French Dispatch. Here's what's good about it. His movies are so much fun to look at. If you actually look at the frame, there's so much in there. There's just like the art direction is spectacular, production design. Like he crams so much in there, and it's so detailed and so meticulous. And at its best, it's charming and it's witty and it's whimsical. But at its worst, it's insufferable and self-indulgent. So this story, again, he's got all the regulars. I tell you what, the cast, they all love working with this guy. Bill Murray will never say no to working with Wes Anderson. You're never going to get a no from Jason Schwartzman. Never going to get a no from Owen Wilson. All these guys love it. Willem Dafoe shows up in the movie. So he gets this cast, which, I mean, these actors are phenomenal. Not only those guys I mentioned, but also Frances McDormand, Tilda Swinton, Benicio Del Toro, Adrian Brody, who was in the George Ealing Limited. But here's what the story is. A love letter to journalists set in an outpost of an American newspaper in a fictional 20th century French city that brings to life a collection of stories published in the French Dispatch magazine. So the first scene you see, Bill Murray is the editor, and he's going over some stories, and unfortunately he has passed away. So they go the story in reverse. Let's see what the French Dispatch was all about, this magazine that this editor put together. So it's three separate stories, three vignettes, which are actual stories that were featured in the magazine. So the first story is actually genuinely funny. Benicio Del Toro plays a prisoner who has a really great artistic streak. And Adrian Brody plays the guy who wants to capitalize on this. He plays Julian Cadazio, Del Toro's Moses Rosenthaler. So Benicio Del Toro, his painting, he's literally painting a nude woman. Like, well, the first scene, what is this? And by the way, the color palette, it goes from color to black and white, just painting a nude woman. But he's got this great artistic streak. Adrian Brody goes and meets him, this rat-a-tat-patter. He's like, I like what you're doing. I know you're a convict. I know you've murdered people, but I want to buy your painting. I think it's worth a lot of money. Can I give you 250 francs? They go back and forth. It's funny. It's clever. And that whole section I really like because it was inventive. And again, it's the best of Wes Anderson. The second story is about Timothée Chalamet and Frances McDormand. I don't want to, again, give too much away, but it's just pointless. Like, I'm watching the story, and I'm like, why is this interesting or funny or any of the above? And then the third story, which involves Jeffrey Wright as a writer talking about his past and talking about his books, There's one sequence that goes into animation. And again, if you see a lot of movies like me, Cody, you appreciate films that are different. You go, hey, I don't often see a movie in which there's three small stories and they're in black and white and then there's an animation sequence for 5 minutes. So I always applaud Wes Anderson's originality and his unique sensibilities. But I got to be honest with you. If I said to you, Chris, you're really going to like this movie, I'd be lying. I think of the hour 45 minutes, I love the first story and the other two I was kind of like, meh. So I'm going to give this film 2 Maple Leafs. I want to give it more because, again, there's so many damn superhero movies, as you and I have talked about. There's so many cookie-cutter movies. At least Wes Anderson makes different movies, and there's nothing quite like his films. But I have to be honest. Would I rewatch this movie? No. Do I think it's as good as his other movies? No. So, unfortunately, I'm going to have to give it 2 Maple Leafs. But if you like something different, I'd recommend it.
I just realized in this, I Googled it. I don't think I've seen a single Wes Anderson movie. I've seen like I think I've seen parts of the Royal Tenenbaums, but it was when I was young, so I don't really remember it.
But you're familiar with it. If I said you Rushmore, you would know what I'm talking about. Obviously.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And that's why I don't know why I haven't, because I do, like you, like movies and directors that just do stuff that's different. Right. So I want to investigate. I want to watch the Royal Tenenbaums since you say that's his best. And this one kind of intrigued me. You see that the way the preview starts with Owen Wilson on his bike, like that was like that kind of was an intriguing start to a preview, but no, I did not see it. And but I'm intrigued by it. Wes Anderson, what's wrong with me? Why have I never seen a Wes Anderson movie?
Now, this is good. This is good homework for you. So either watch Rushmore or Royal Tenenbaums. I think they're both great. I personally prefer Tenenbaums. Some people prefer Rushmore. I think you'd like either one. So that's Chris Cody's homework. We'll do that for another time. French Dispatch. In many ways, it feels like a parody of a Wes Anderson movie. So that should not be the one that you first watch. Go watch the other ones first. And then if you ever feel really bored and want to watch the French Dispatch, you can do so. A couple of reviews from the film. Adam Naiman of Reverse Shot. The three major episodes in the French Dispatch are of roughly equivalent length, weight, and quality. Although, to be honest, I only really liked the first one. So same as me, the Del Toro story. Amy Nicholson loved it from Film Week. I think it's marvelous from minute to minute. So French Dispatch, currently in theaters, from Wes Anderson. He directed it, as he does all his films, and co-wrote it this time with Roman Coppola and Hugo Guinness. That is the new. The wild card is still coming, which is Jeffrey Lyons, noted film critic. But the old is Monster's Ball, 20th anniversary. Oh, by the way, I have to tell you, the most memorable line from the movie. You know, when I go to the movies, people ask me, do I take a notepad? I don't. I should start doing it, though, because sometimes I want to make notes. So I quickly type this into my phone. The one aspect of Timothée Chalamet, which, again, because I do like to work blue, he's talking about this girl he's dating, and the voiceover says, she watched me pee. Would you still remember the taste of my tool on her tongue, I wondered.
And
I
said, Jesus. Okay,
that's a pretty unique line, only from a Wes Anderson movie. Like, imagine, back. Cody, if you, would you ever in life be doing anything and, like, in your voiceover say, would she still remember the taste of my tool on her tongue?
I would not.
Monsters Ball, 20th anniversary. Now we get heavy and serious. After a family tragedy, a racist prison guard reexamines his attitudes while falling in love with the African-American wife of the last prisoner he executed. This film came out, you know, that great indie stretch of the 90s and early 2000s. Billy Bob Thornton was a remarkable actor of that era. Sling Blade, of course, he won an Academy Award. The Man Who Wasn't There is one of my favorites with the Coen brothers and Monsters Ball. He's a previous guest on Cinephile. We're nearing episode 200. I think this is number 198. And Billy Bob Thornton is definitely in my top 10 guests we've ever had on Cinephile. He came by the studio. He came to ESPN. He was promoting Bad Santa 2.
Did Booger he have a vibe? He looks like he'd have a vibe.
Oh, yeah. Booger McFarlane was cutting my grass. Like, I'm trying to get him in the studio, and Booger interrupts and just starts just wearing him out. And Billy Bob was very nice. And then eventually Booger says, like, I'm Booger McFarlane. Billy Bob says, no, I know who you are. But then thankfully he turned to me and said, I know who you are. I'm like, yeah, all right, let's go. Huge St. Louis Cardinals fan. You know, I obviously want to talk baseball. And that, like, oh, the great, literally, the joys of doing this podcast. We do the pod at the end. He turned to me because, oh, I knew you knew movies, but I didn't know you knew that much. So I'm like, yes, props to Billy Bob Thornton. So I love the guy. Before I start talking about the film, though, I'm thrilled that Chris Cody attempted to watch it. You got through 30 minutes. What do you think so far of Monsters Ball?
I was enjoying it. I mean, Billy Bob Thornton, a real jerk so far in the movie. I don't know if he has like a turn where he becomes a nicer guy. I had Green Mile vibes the first half hour, you know, it's like for what they do for a living. But no, I was into it. It wasn't that I wasn't into it. I just had to go do something and I never got back to it. But I'm going to finish it. So maybe in a couple weeks, I'll give you my Monsters Ball review. But I'm more curious. You mentioned him knowing who you are. Now, that got me thinking, who's the most famous person that knows who you are?
It's Michael Keaton, Will Arnett, Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah.
It's in that film. Mahershala Ali. I mean, he's won 2 Academy Awards.
So you don't think Bob De Niro remember? Like, if you said, if I just said to Bob De Niro right now, Adnan Virk, you don't think he'd be like, oh, that's a TV guy. He does Baseball Tonight. No.
I love his takes on the Jays. So he'd have no idea what I'm talking about. But I think the Michael Keaton, Billy Bob Thornton, like that's pretty good for me. I'll take those. Maybe Will Mark
Arnett,
Wahlberg?
Probably not on their level in terms of fame, right? Okay. I mean, Will Arnett, he's well-known, but...
I don't think Mark Wahlberg would know who I am. Maybe Matthew McConaughey. McConaughey apparently is a pretty big sports guy, and he's a big Russillo guy, so he may have heard me a lot with Ryan. I think McConaughey's pretty good star power.
All right, that's good.
Who's the most famous person that would know? Dan Marino.
I don't know. He would have no clue who I am. Maybe Dwayne Wade.
Dwayne Wade would know who you are?
Because he's a fan of, like, he's been on the Levitard show a bunch. Like, there's... No, he doesn't know who I am. What am I thinking? I don't know. I'll get back to you next week. This is a good game.
This is a good game. I'm going to go Dwayne Wade for now. As far as the film itself is concerned, great performances across the board. Billy Bob Thornton, as Chris said, plays a very nasty guy, racist prison guard, horrible father to his son, the late, great Heath Ledger. You know, if you want to see another Heath Ledger film that you may have overlooked over the years, he plays his son, very tortured. Their job, as I said, they're prison guards. I mean, they're walking Puff Daddy. That's right. Sean Puffy Combs is living his last days, and Billy Bob and Heath Ledger have to do the last walk with him. His wife is the great Halle Berry, who plays Letitia Musgrove, the best performance of her career. She won the Academy Award Best Actress. I believe the first black actress to win Best Actress. I believe I had that right, back in 2001, because Denzel won for Training Day. Sidney Poitier won Best Actor years ago, Lily's in the Field, but the fact that Halle Berry and Denzel won that year, that was history-making, and she deserves it. I mean, her performance is raw, vulnerable. She sees her husband die in death row. She has a son who's obese and also endures a tragedy, and therefore she finds some compassion. I don't want to spoil this now for Cody, but she finds a little bit of compassion there, I believe, Bob Thornton's character. What the film is very much known for, I remember the time, this very graphic sex scene. I want you to make me feel good. That'll make sense after you see the movie. Halle Berry, and it's intercut with this caged bird. The reason I mention this is in the DVD, which of course I own, the director's commentary is hysterical. Mark Forster is talking. He's like a very serious guy. And Billy Bob Thornton is also in the commentary track, and he's like the wise ass in the room, just constantly making jokes. Like, Mark Forster is talking about, hey, we shot this deep in the Deep South, and it's very serious, and the subject matter is about race relations and men and women and finding love. And then Billy Bob's just there, like, tossed in wisecracks. If you ever have the DVD or the time to get the commentary track, take a listen. And one other thought, Peter Boyle, who was amazing in Taxi Driver. Remember that great scene where De Niro's trying to get some advice from him? And De Niro then says, that's like the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Peter Boyle, who also you know from Everybody Loves Raymond, this is a much different role for him. This is not Ray Romano's dad. This is the very racist father, yes, Billy Bob Thornton's character. He has an excellent scene with Halle Berry as well, in which he comes to the house. So I don't want to spoil too much, but 20th anniversary, Monsters Ball. If you like Halle Berry, you'll love it. If you want to see a graphic sex scene of her and Billy Bob Thornton, you'll love it. And if you're a Billy Bob Thornton fan like me, you'll love it. I just thought it was an excellent, excellent film. 20th anniversary. It's worth a revisit. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have not gone to that scene yet. But no, you were right. Halle Berry, the only black actress to ever win. A bunch have been nominated, but in 2001, she's the only one that's won still.
Jeez, that's crazy. Come on, Academy. Let's get going. Only one, Halle Berry. It is an awesome performance. There's no question about it. So two movies to check out. By the way, a couple of critic reviews here. Carl Quinn of The Age. Letitia and Hank come together in their grief, and when they do, when in particular they seek some kind of punishment and absolution in sex, it makes for one of the most intense, moving, and real moments you're ever likely to witness on film. I want you to make me feel good. Neil Minow of Common Sense Media, this brutal movie is for adults only. How about that review? This brutal movie is for adults only. And Mark Carroll of Chicago Tribune, a serious movie made by seriously talented people, and I never quite came around to it. Come on, Mark, you suck. Monsters Ball is a great movie. That's the old Monsters Ball. The new is The French Dispatch. And now the wild card, father of Ben Lyons and author and film critic, Jeffrey Lyons. It's a real pleasure to bring in one of the best film critics ever. His name is Jeffrey Lyons. He's also spawned Ben Lyons, a good friend of mine and a friend here of Cinephile. We're going to talk some movies today with Jeffrey. We're going to talk about his beloved Boston Red Sox, who unfortunately fell to the Houston Astros. We're also going to talk about Hemingway and Me. Excellent new book, Letters, Anecdotes, and Memories of a Life-Changing Friendship, which Jeffrey wrote. It's all about the relationship not only he had with Ernest Hemingway, one of the greatest writers of all time, arguably the greatest American writer of the 20th century, but also his father, Leonard Lyons, Ben's grandfather, had with Ernie Hemingway. Jeffrey, let's begin with the book here. I when I go through it, Jeffrey, I bookmark all the things I find interesting. I love the fact that you have so many great stories about your dad's relationship with Hemingway. Two guys who clearly could not be more dissimilar. Hemingway, brawny, shirt off, out there fishing, hunting, picking up women, carousing. Your dad, not a teetotaler, urbane New York writer, and yet he and Hemingway seem to have so much in common. Do you think it came down to the fact they were both brilliant writers and respected each other for that? Why do you think they got along so well?
He was a teetotaler, which means he didn't drink at all. Was not a teetotaler. He trusted my father. I think it was Sherman Billingsley or Toots Shore who introduced him in the late 30s. And Hemingway started a chat with my dad, and he began to tell him stories. And my father only printed what Hemingway said, nothing in confidence. What Hemingway said, you can use this and use that. And other columnists were not like that back then. You know, New York had about 11 newspapers back then. And when I was growing up, we had seven papers. Every day we had seven papers to read what the other columnists said. And I grew up knowing all who all those people were. And Hemingway trusted him, and he didn't trust many other people. And when my dad would go on a flight, he would sometimes ask people to write guest columns. Jimmy Durante wrote one saying he was the prize fighter. He had two fights, one in the ring, a knockout, and when the second one came when he got home. But also Margaret Bourke White, people like that. But Hemingway refused to do it. He said, that's not the kind of writing I can do. But my dad got Salvador Dali to write a guest column. It was a different world. But when Hemingway was hunting lions and elephants back in the day when you could do that, and exposing himself to danger, not like some people we know in recent years who look through a telescope and kill an animal. And my dad was hunting stories around New York, so they had that in common.
Hunters and gatherers of a different type. Like I said, I'm just going to dive into sections that I laughed at. This was this is when Gary Cooper was in For Whom the Bell Tolls, one of my favorite books. John McCain, one of his favorite books. He was featured in the Ken Burns documentary. The film stars Ingrid Bergman, Gary Cooper. He didn't take his coat off, said Hemingway of his pal Cooper's portrayal. Cooper portrayed Robert Jordan, the American volunteer fighting with the doomed Republicans in the Spanish Civil War. That's a hell of a way for a guy to make love with his coat on.
That's true. That was probably the director's call. But one time he and Cooper were driving in Montana, I guess it was, and they stopped in a gas station. And Cooper filled up the car, or as they used to call them, filling station. And he wrote a check for $2 or something. Hemingway said, why'd you do that? He said, I know he'll never cash the check. He'll want to frame it. And they went to another filling station. And of course, they didn't know who Hemingway was. And they...
Oh, it's funny when those things work out. You think the fame is there and it isn't. You mentioned the fact, listen, the hunting was so much about it, about his life, and certainly he had a passion for it. This is interesting here. You're talking about, he loaded the .22 rifle, then showed my 14-year-old brother George how to hold it. The boy fired and missed. You've got to shoot as if it's going to kill you if you don't kill it, Papa told him. George fired again, the bottle smashed dead center. Then my second son, Warren, took the gun, and Papa showed him how to aim. Warren seemed nervous, and Hemingway talked to him softly. You've got to get calm first, calm inside, as if you're in a church when that lion's coming toward you. You get calm inside, you've got something to believe in. Then shoot the son of a bitch. There's a real artistry to this, wasn't it?
If you go to YouTube and you type in Hemingway and the Lion's Family, you will see those moments. And you will see him putting his arm around me, teaching me how to fire. You know, I loved wet cowboy pictures when I was growing up. I loved watching cowboy pictures on TV. And to see, I walked around with two plastic guns different times. But to see a great writer say, we've had bandits here in Cuba. Here, I'm going to show you how to fire a gun. My eyes were coming out of my head. And he noticed in that quote that you gave, he said, when the lion is coming towards you. That's how he hunted. He didn't assassinate animals like some of these trophy hunters today, 200 yards away through a telescope. He put himself in danger. I'm not justifying shooting animals. Those were different times, too. He had an elephant charge and lion charge and cheetahs, all those kind of. He exposed himself to danger.
He's also one of the toughest guys who ever lived. So many times he cheated death. He's crashes. He served in wars. How about this? This is page 65. After proper examination, they found I bought it pretty thoroughly. Full concussion. Loss of sight of left eye. Optic nerve is regenerating okay. Loss of hearing left ear. Ruptured right kidney. Ditto liver and spleen. Intestines collapsed. Paralysis of spleen. Couldn't shit for 22 days. Then it's 62 movements. Complete with cramps in 20 hours, all standing up. If I sit down, my lower intestine comes out. Running as an indestructible can be a tough trade. So we'll skip the atrocities, but tell the boys nothing is bad if you say to it, go fuck yourself.
Right. Today, this would be called too much information. my dad never had anything like that happen to him, thank God. I will say this, after the first plane crash, they were rescued by a rescue plane, and the second plane crashed. And all the other columnists and writers were saying Hemingway is dead. And it was like my father had that column prepared, but he had another column prepared saying, thank goodness he's, and Hemingway got out of it alive. And Hemingway was in my father's debt for not reporting that he had been killed. But by waiting, let's get, that's how we knew we could trust him.
You mentioned the fact it was a different time in there. What I really loved about the book, once again, we're talking with Jeffrey Lyons. Go buy this book. It's called Hemingway and Me. The foreword is by Liam Neeson. What I loved about it was your honesty. As you've said, it was a different time. You yourself were enraptured and fascinated by bullfights. Yeah. And today you can ask a certain group of people, let's say that's horrific. It's what a horrible practice. And you said, listen, as a young man, I was enamored of it. I could see the artistry behind it. And I thought that was interesting the way you described bullfighting and why you were excited by it.
And they still are held on, and I'm still enraptured by it. It's not what it once was. It's not a sport, and I can't defend it here. And any aficionado would oppose bullfighting in this country. But the people who oppose it, they're right. Why don't they also go after people who fire shotguns at helpless birds or whip horses so they can run faster, and they breed horses with spindly legs and go fishing and put a hook in a fish? And you want to go to all those. They're almost as culpable. A fighting bull is the most dangerous animal in the world. It can beat a racehorse in 100 yards, jump higher than a kangaroo, and charge anything that moves. It's not the color that makes them charge. He sees red is a misnomer. It's the movement. And when they're with their brothers, I've been in the fields with fighting bulls, they are timid. But if you corner them, you put them in an arena, they go out and look for something to kill. It's an amazing breed. They live longer than, I'm not trying to justify it, I'm trying to explain it. They live longer than the bull that's killed in a slaughterhouse hung upside down and having its throat slit. And they live among all the cows they want, and they live in beautiful ranches. And what they do is they put the salt lick about a quarter of a mile away from the water. So when they lick the salt, they walk over in some ranches, hard terrain strengthens their legs. And the ganaderias, where those are the ranches where they raise fighting bulls, are the same as Calumet Farms has a certain kind of racehorse, and another farm has another kind of racehorse, same with fighting bulls. And you contract to fight bulls from a certain ranch because you know those bulls' tendencies.
It's fascinating. I love that you're an authority on the subject. I was talking to Ben the other day how much I enjoyed the book, and I said I really liked how you talked to different actors who played Hemingway. Ben said, of course, that was his idea, and specifically Corey Stoll. He had great stories about playing Hemingway in the Woody Allen film Midnight in Paris.
All of them played Hemingway, most of them at the end of his life or the middle part of his life. They did it in a completely different way. In speaking of that movie, Midnight in Paris, Woody did a funny thing. There's a bullfighter character in it, and he calls himself Juan Belmonte, who was a great bullfighter. But he's played by some very handsome Swedish actor I haven't seen before or since, because Americans think of bullfighters as Rudolph Valentino and all these. But Juan Belmonte was a little banty-legged man who couldn't get out of the way of the big lumbering bulls of his era. So he moved him out of his way and revolutionized bullfighting. So he looked nothing like him. But Robert Evans played Juan Romero, I think, in The Sun Also Rises. And Robert Evans went to Yankee Stadium the opening game of the 1957 World Series. And as you know, right before the first pitch, there's a hush on the stadium. A perfectly tailored suit behind a perfectly tailored shirt, behind a perfectly manicured hand, in front of Hemingway's vision, and said, "Mr. Hemingway, I play the bullfighter in The Sun Also Rises." And Hemingway, who had seen the rush, said, "No, you didn't." I used to kid him about that all the time, because he knew he was a handsome, but terrible actor, who later went on to save Paramount Pictures and become a Hollywood executive.
I was about to say, The Godfather and Chinatown and Love Story and all the rest of it, Robert Evans and all. And The Kid Stays in the Picture, by the way. Great book and documentary, as you know. I think all of Hemingway's work still holds up, particularly the early stuff. The Sun Also Rises, I think, is incredible. Farewell to Arms, I love that last section, because as one of the writers explained it in the Ken Burns documentary, you get all the manly stuff, the heroism and the war, but there's real heartbreak at the end of the Farewell to Arms. Like, it's a really genuinely sad story about childbirth and the child dying at the end. For you, personal favorite of Hemingway's, For Whom the Bell Tolls, Old Man of the Sea?
A couple of them. One you're not going to be able to pinpoint was The Dangerous Summer. That's 59. It was published posthumously. It's not a novel. It's about the summer that Antonio Ordóñez, his godson, mano a mano, which means hand to hand, not man to man, mano a mano, with his brother-in-law, Luis Miguel Dominguín. They went all over Spain. Instead of three matadors facing two bulls apiece, two matadors faced three bulls apiece. I say that because in 1961, a month before he died, Hemingway had been told that I was nuts about bullfighting. I'd been to Spain two summers to learn Spanish, and he arranged for me to travel with his godson, Antonio Ordóñez. And he thought it would be for 2 weeks. It turned into seven summers. Antonio became a brother to me. And his grandsons, Francisco and Cayetano, their father was killed in the arena. The mother didn't want them to become bullfighters, so they came to us and we sent them to camps in Maine. Of course, they became great bullfighters. If you go to 60 Minutes, Blood Brothers, you'll see the late Bob Simons, full hour on 60 Minutes about the two brothers. But Antonio was unlike other bullfighters, he had an intellectual curiosity. My father got him a tour of the UN from Secretary General U Thant. And he turned to the Secretary General and said, I owe this to the Fighting Bulls. If it weren't for the Bulls, I'd be a shoeshine boy in my hometown of Ronda, where bullfighting was first done. And Antonio could find a Spanish, he didn't speak a word of it. He knew how to say one thing in English. Okay, Mac. And he could find a Spanish-speaking waiter in Bondurant, Wyoming. He explored this country with a curiosity most bullfighters don't have. He was the most amazing guy I ever knew. And cigarettes killed him, not the Bulls. But he was the greatest. Hemingway anointed him the better of the two brothers. Dominguín had the suit designed by Picasso and the girlfriend Ava Gardner, and they were the great rivals. And in 1971, I was headed to spend that summer with Antonio, and Dominguín had been on the Dick Cavett Show the night before, and I ran into him in the airport, and he knew my dad, so I said, I was going to spend the summer with the competition, your brother-in-law. He said, come with me too. So I spent a day traveling with his entourage. And besides Hotchner, Hemingway's editor, and Hemingway, the only one who's traveled with both of those great matadors. So in that regard, The Dangerous Summer is one of my favorites. But also, The Sun Also Rises. It's just, and if you go to Pamplona, there are adjoining streets, Calle Ernesto Hemingway and Calle Orson Welles. Orson taught me the basics of bullfighting. Barnaby Conrad, the great writer, talked to me about, I read all his books about bullfighting. Orson Welles and Daryl Zanuck. We were on the set of The Sun Also Rises and Daryl Zanuck. So there I was, 14, 15 years old, learning from these people. So when I was ready in 61 to travel with him, I knew what was going on. I didn't have to be schooled in anything. I was ready.
It's amazing, too. Like, it reminds me of what you're talking about, Hemingway, and the way he was. Like, I've seen some clips of him, and it's antithetical to what you might examine, specifically physically. Like, his voice, he had, like, kind of a higher Midwestern twang, right? Like, you picture this, like, baritone voice. That's not what Ernest Hemingway sounded like.
Almost like, what was her name? John Gilbert, the silent screen star, whose career was ruined when sound pictures came because he had a high-pitched voice. I mean, it wasn't like that at all. But that would not go with the image. So actors were smart not to do that, not to try to replicate that. But we were talking about traveling in Spain. I'm with the bullfighters in the third of the three cars in the entourage in 1964. I'm sitting in the front seat. We're in the middle of Spain. I turn on the radio, the shortwave, and I get Phil Rizzuto doing a Yankee-Cleveland game. And now I got to explain to the guys what a earned run average is and what a ground ball outs is. And it was Leon's first game. And when I saw him at spring training, I explained it to him. And he said, yes. And he started to give me a description of every single pitch of that game, which I in Spain with bullfighters in a DeSoto limousine going top speed 55 miles an hour.
You can't get better than that story. Baseball and movies, Jeffrey Lyons dominates them all. Hemingway and Me, I encourage everyone to check out the book, Letters, Anecdotes, and Memories of a Life-Changing Friendship. Couple of movie topics for you. One is that I talked to George Gallo last year, and I brought you up because I said, you know, you made a film, which everyone always asks, what's your favorite Christmas movie? And I mentioned this film called 29th Street, which you know George Gallo wrote and directed. And I said, Jeffrey Lyons had the perfect blurb for it. The reason I even watched the movie was the video cassette said, it's a cross between Goodfellas and It's a Wonderful Life. And I said that to George Gallo, and he said, yeah, that was perfect. He said, when Jeffrey said that, like, you nailed my exact film. He just said it like in one sentence rather than making an hour and 45-minute movie. I don't know what memories you have of that film. This is the 30th anniversary this year. Danny Aiello, Anthony LaPaglia. I think it's a great film.
I wonder what Joey Gallo thought of the film. But anyway, Danny Aiello and I founded the New York Show League after we were kicked out of the Broadway Show League because we insisted on fast pitch softball. Not windmill, but not that nerdy lob ball. Fast pitch softball. And I played 49 seasons. Danny called himself the Vic Power of Central Park, the greatest field. And I loved it. And he said he bought one ticket. The true story, guy bought one ticket for the lottery, and he won the lottery. And he was perfect for the role. And the best line is played by Robert Forster, I think, who plays his father. And the line is, what are you, a mamaluke? And that's the second line of the movie. I miss his friendship a lot.
Incredible actor, of course, Do the Right Thing, you know, Boycott Sal's. You can't do much better than Danny Aiello in that movie. Dune, I asked Ben, I go, what did your dad think? He goes, I'm not going to force my dad to watch Dune. There's just no way. But you did watch a film that which might win Best Actress for an actress, Kristen Stewart. You and Ben just saw the movie. Tell us about it.
Called Spencer. And when I heard that she was playing, it's not about Jim Spencer, the old Yankee. I thought it was going to just retell everything about how Princess Di met and died. No, it's the true story. If I can invent a word, fabulized, it's a fable of the 3 days she spent at one of the dreary royal estates with the family. And the family, the royal family, are never identified by name, but we know who they are, how they were cold and aloof to her, and how she was saying, get me out of here, and slowly going mad there. And you understand what happened, what the real story between the two of them were. And it's a great performance. Her British accent is perfect. And I didn't know she had it. I thought she was, the Twilight girl. She played Jean Seberg, and she was more remarkable in it. So she'll be a strong Oscar contender. You never know. Cary Grant never won an Oscar. Judy Garland never won an Oscar. Marlene Dietrich never won an Oscar.
Will Ferrell.
Kirk Douglas never won an Oscar. He was awarded an Oscar, never won. So you never know with them.
It does always get frustrating. And last one, just because when you're talking to a film critic, you've seen more movies than people could ever imagine. I never want to ask people what's your favorite film. I think that's impossible to answer. But give us some of your favorites.
Favorite is The Graduate. And, you know, I didn't go see the Dune film. I didn't understand the first one. And I might be saying, unfortunately, my seat was facing the screen. I'm not into what's the one with Will Smith and the Matrix. Life is too short. As I want. I'm heard on radio. It's my show, my report. I can pick. I don't always like the movie. Like I had a wonderful movie yesterday called Spanish Lessons with Mark and Natalie Morales, not the TV correspondent. And it's about a Spanish teacher in Colombia teaching via Zoom to a guy in Oakland, California. And they form an unusual relationship. And those are the kind of films that need to have people talking about them. Not just if you look at a lot of TV, all the ads have people with guns in them and violence and special effects, but there's a room for many other kinds of film. But The Graduate is my favorite film. I saw it at the right time of my life. And so one day, if I have a minute, it's on our 15th wedding anniversary. I ran into Paul Simon in the morning. Oh, my Graduate, my favorite. I ran into Art Garfunkel, my brother's roommate in college, the other side of the same. And then across the street, we're heading out to dinner with Dustin Hoffman with his then wife. He said, I know The Graduate's your favorite film, but you haven't been kind to me since. We're kidding around. About 15 minutes. Now, most guys don't like to stand and chat for 15 minutes. They pull a George Bush and look at their watch. He said, where are you going? I said, we're going to this little French restaurant, and it's our wedding anniversary. The time we got there, there's a bottle of champagne from him. So I was saying, I don't care if you make, what's that film he did with Warren Beatty?
Ishtar.
I don't care if you make Ishtar 2. And I should have said that, because Ishtar is one of the worst films you can see.
Horrific. Well, let's get out of here with this. Give me an Al Pacino story, because I asked you once about De Niro, and you said, listen, he's one of the worst interviews I've ever suffered through in my life. I can't tell you a great De Niro story. But what about Al? Do you have a Pacino story for me?
Direct Pacino story. I married a flight attendant for TWA, and the woman who introduced me to my wife was a woman named Suzanne Curry. And one day she's in the shower and the doorbell rings. She's about 5'10". Doorbell rings and all she can see in the peephole is a bouquet of flowers. And he says, Linda? She said, no, I think you have the wrong room. He says, well, my name is Al Pacino and I've just landed a role in a movie called The Godfather. Would you have dinner with me? She said, thank you very much. I can't. So that's my shortstop on the Broadway show league, by the way, Al Pacino.
Right, Pacino, big baseball guy, of course, born in the Bronx. Jeffrey Lyons is the best. I've had the pleasure of having a burger with him at Wahlburgers just outside Fenway Park with his son, Ben. He's been a guest on MLB Network a year or two ago. I think we had you on pre-pandemic, talking movies, talking baseball. Check out Hemingway and Me, his new book, Letters, Anecdotes, and Memories of a Life-Changing Friendship. Keep watching MLB Network. I appreciate your support, and I love the movie talk, and obviously I love Ben. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks.
Jeffrey Lyons, make sure you go read Hemingway and Me. He also has a book about the Boston Red Sox, which he sent me. But as you can tell, I had no interest in talking with the Boston Red Sox with him. But Jeffrey Lyons has two new books out, Hemingway and Me and the Boston Red Sox.
And the man can sing. And the man can sing.
Yeah, what did you think of the interview overall? Like, I mean, you love Ben Lyons, as do I. Ben's the best. What did you think of his father?
I mean, I'm biased because I like Ben Lyons and his dad. I could just see where all the delightfulness comes from. But, you know, his dad also, Ben Lyons seems like the ultimate nice guy. Jeffrey Lyons looks like he'll tell you how he really feels if he needs to, though.
But I always think it's fascinating. Like, people meet you and immediately go, oh, your dad's Greg. Oh, of course, I've been reading him for years, whatever. Yeah. So it's funny when you are the son of a recognizable person, right? Whenever you meet people, people already think they know you because, like, oh, I know your dad, of course, Greg Cody. And especially now with the show, oh, your grandma, the hard out, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, my dad's more than just that. He's actually my father. Because you're right. I'll say this. When you do meet the son of someone you know, you do start to make connections, meaning you're very funny, and I see where the humor comes with Greg,
yes,
your dad. So similarly with Ben and Jeff, like Ben is a great storyteller, and obviously, as you just heard, Jeffrey Lyons is nothing if not a great storyteller.
Yep. No, they're great. Both Lyons. I'm a big fan of the Lyons.
The Lyons.
I honestly only remember, I only knew Ben Lyons, like we were people that followed each other. Our interview, our friendship has taken a step, me and Ben Lyons. We might even get dinner sometime. I might get dinner with Ben Lyons soon.
Well, listen, I don't know how much people heard in the pod, how much you edited it out, but like he was excited to talk to you. Like he's always happy, but he was like, Cody, what's up? Like he dropped about 7 Levitar references. So he was.
I see a nice 6-way dinner at some point with Adnan, his wife, me, my wife, Ben, and his wife. Maybe we'll even bring Jeff, his dad.
Okay, that'd be great if his dad shows up as well, just to tell us
some
stories.
Let's
go.
Let's do this.
A little singing. All right.
Love a good dinner.
Look forward to that 7-way dinner at some point. Yeah. In the meantime,
who
thanks
pays?
So much.
That'd be a weird pay situation. How would that work? Like, are we all thrown in credit cards there?
We'll just get a Venmo going.
I mean, Adnan and Ben are clearly the most successful, and Jeff are so much more successful than little
old
Chris.
You and your wife
so,
are just
like,
there.
I just feel like.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Cody, have another piece of cheesecake. Not me. No problem. We'll go to Prime 112.
Another bottle of wine? Another butt for the table? Let's go.
Look forward to that dinner. Look forward to the next Cinephile. Please go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, review. One last minute, I did want to ask you, just say congratulations to Metalark. If you're not aware, John Skipper, Dan Levitard, and company signing a first look deal with Apple. People are asking me, what does that mean for Cinephile? I said, I think nothing, but it's just good news for the company, right?
It means that all my ideas that I pitch won't get thrown to Apple. I feel like those will reach some sort of buffer because, like, we are in, I'm kind of in a spot now. You are too, essentially. You throw a good documentary idea at Dan, boom, next thing you know, you're an EP on something. So, like, I have been racking my brain. You see now where I'm turning this. I'm turning this announcement into how can I create something. But no, this is really cool for the company. And it's just, this company has, it's been like 6 months and they're kicking ass so far. It's pretty cool.
Love it. Shit got real. Coming up on next week in Cinephile, Leonard Maltin, the great film critic. He has a new book coming out. Going to talk to him about that. Plus the new film, Spencer. Ben Lyons told me Kristen Stewart from Twilight. He said she's definitely going to get an Academy Award nomination. She might even win the Oscar. She plays Lady Diana, a new film called Spencer. It's out in theaters. I'll have my review for you next week. Until then, I'll see you at the movies.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.